On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The stories of the Arabian Nights teem with genies, riches, jealous kings, wily princesses, distant lands, sorcerers. They break the laws of science to bring enchantment, says my guest today. An enchantment, she says, that we need. This hour On Point, a new look at the 1001 Nights. You can join the conversation. Do you know the story of how these stories came to be, how they enchanted the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from London is Marina Warner, a real eminence in the study of the stories of magic, fairy tales, myth, mythography. She's a professor at the University of Essex. She's gone deep on the Virgin Mary, Joan of Arc. She's author of the new book, Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. Marina Warner, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you very much for asking me on.
Take us back. Tell us where, I'm looking at a couple of collections of this here. Now you've done your own. You've retold a dozen or more of these stories, but there are many more than that in the great collections. Where did the 1001 Nights, the Arabian Nights, where does this come from?
They're really a medieval collection of stories that many, many people told one another right across, not only in Arabic, but Persia, India, ancient Greece. And then, we have many traces in some of, in Chaucer and Shakespeare. So it's quite mysterious, but the book was actually printed for the first time in French. It wasn't printed in Arabic before the French translation, which is 1704, right at the very beginning of the Age of Reason. And that really caught my attention. I thought, why did this book take off? Because it was a huge hit. It was the great bestseller of the time. And then went on, of course, in various transformations. But why did it take on then? Why did the people of the Enlightenment, the readers, want to imitate this, want to read it, want to talk to each other about it? And so I thought, maybe this magic, maybe the enchantments in this book have another dimension that is revelatory of something deeper. And they understood that reason alone could not perhaps seek out all the questions that they wanted to ask and or address the mysteries they wanted to look at. That's what captured me.
I can see that, and you write very compellingly about it. Here you've got these folk tales, in a way, with medieval Arabic and Persian and Indian, Turkish, Egyptian, Mesopotamian folklore all wrapped in here. And then of all things, at the very beginning of the Age of Reason, you have this, it becomes a sensation in Europe. Do you think they were really looking there for something deeper, consciously looking for something deeper they needed to supplement reason? Or had their move to reason left them hungry for something that they weren't cultivating so rigorously in Europe at that time?
Yes, I think that's right. I think there's a kind of element of disguise that if you move into the Orient, if you, as it were, put on a turban to write, wear a dressing gown and slippers, and, smoke a hubbly bubbly, you kind of can then do things which you're not permitted to do because they're kind of too fanciful, too perhaps childish and so forth. And many people, some of the great minds, Voltaire, for example, is probably the greatest, adopted the Oriental tale in order to write his political attacks on the system of his time. But I think the chief thing that I'd go for is that the book places at the center of its plot the idea that stories can save your life. And that has got a very powerful message about the arts and literature. And, Shahrazad is very subtle. She begins with quite misogynist stories which seem to kind of agree with the Sultan who wants to kill all women because they're treacherous and wily and wicked and adulterous and so forth. Mm. And she seems to be agreeing with him. But then gradually she expands the range of human behaviors and understanding and feelings. And he's gradually finding himself, and we, of course, are in the position of the Sultan. We're the readers, we're the listeners. Mm-hmm. And he finds himself, hearing about courageous young women, brave older women, the kind of depths and range of human feelings, and that people also have motives that are complex. And the other thing that happens, as for instance in the story of the King Yunan and the Doctor Duban, is you're warned about acting unjustly. You will be punished if you act unjustly.
Take us back, if you'd be good enough, Marina Warner, because not everyone reads this anymore, and even those who do have maybe only a passing familiarity with this framework, just broad stroke. But if you get into the 1001 Nights and you really look at the, situate us in that literal framework here, who's the Sultan? Who is Shahrazad? Why is he killing somebody every morning until she shows up? What's her sister and his brother have to do with it? Put us in the framing of this story.
Well, it begins with a sultan coming back by chance because he's left something in his palace when he goes out hunting. So he comes back to the palace, and what does he find? His wife in bed with and then it's described in very kind of rather racist terms, this sort of dreadful black slave that she's cavorting with and, having an incredible sort of orgiastic time. So he's absolutely horrified, and he cuts off both their heads and tosses them out of the window.
Okay.
And then this sultan goes to visit his brother, and he finds that he arrives at his brother's palace, and he looks into the palace garden, and his brother is away, and what does he see there?
Even worse
carousing and cavorting. Right. In this case, not just one pair, but all of them. You know, the whole harem is kind of having a massive orgy. So the two brothers decide that they've really had it with women and their revenge. They set out on their journeys to wander the world in grief and sorrow. And the next thing they find is they hide up a tree because an enormous genie appears with a padlocked glass box. And in the padlocked glass box, he lets out his human wife, whom he captured on the day of her wedding.
Okay.
And then when he falls asleep, this creature, this beautiful siren, emerges from the box, and she inveigles the two brothers. She says that if they don't immediately make love to her, she will wake up the genie and he will murder them.
Woman they come across,
so every single woman at the
mind.
Beginning, right. That's right, every single woman is absolutely completely fired up with kind of demonic lust. And actually in a way, this is a very strong trope, in general in literature. Mm. I mean, the misogyny of literature is particularly about women's sexuality. Mm. Eve, it's the same sort of thing. Well, but the whole of the Arabian Nights is really to undo the kind of clot of mad rage that then descends and clouds the minds of these two men.
Take us to Shahrazad,
so it's very,
then.
Very,
the Sultan comes back to his palace
so the Sultan
and decides
comes
what?
Back, yes, and the Sultan comes back to his palace and decides that in order to take revenge, he's going to take a virgin bride every night and cut off her head in the morning. And that way he'll teach women a lesson.
And he's got
the vizier
is ordered to go out and find these brides,
yes,
a new one every night.
That's right. That's right. And the vizier's daughter is Shahrazad. And she has a little sister called Dunyazad. Mm-hmm. And Shahrazad asks her father if she can be the next wife.
I mean, he's looking around for the next because they're running out of candidates, running out of virgins.
That's right.
To
and
give
people are hiding their children, hiding their children, and they're sending them out of the country.
why does she volunteer? Because her father's in trouble if he can't find another, or why?
We're told that she has a scheme. She has had an idea, and that she's very well educated. She has a whole library, and she's never forgotten anything she ever read. Mm. And she says to her little sister, I want you to prompt me. As soon as the Sultan's made love to me that first night, you're to pop up and say, I want a story, my sister dear. Please tell me a story. I can't sleep. So the frame is actually that two young women are telling each other. The elder sister is telling her little sister a story.
And every night it's the same. Every night it's the Sultan and Shahrazad. They make love. Dunyazad pops up, wants another story. She tells that story only to a point, and then comes the ellipsis. If he wants to know the end of it, he can't cut her head off.
Yes, that's right. And he's caught. And in a way, this kind of proves that women are rather cunning. But their cunning is not to do with their, sexual appetites. Their cunning is to do with their intelligence and their emotional breadth. And Shahrazad actually doesn't really, she fades from view. I mean, the stories she tells take up the whole foreground. We never really know much about her. Mm-hmm. Some writers, of course, have taken up who she is and have expanded the character of Shahrazad herself. But she disappears from view. She just has this immense entangled repertory. But her other trick, it's not that she tells a story to a cliffhanger, is that within each story she starts telling other stories.
Right.
So the reason the Sultan can't let go is that there are all these threads.
What about this?
Dangling.
What about that? Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, what happened to him? Where did he go? So one person sort of flies off to pursue his fairy wife, and then we're back in another frame. So it's nested boxes. You know, they're one little box inside another little box, and you never really get out. And that's been imitated by many, many writers since, including Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland.
Of course.
And into that you drop through different levels.
Right. And into that fantastic framework poured story after story after story from all over an enormous region of the world.
Yes, and with marvelous invention. And, you know, when you said people don't know this, absolutely true. I thought I knew them. I thought, well, this book, I will, you know, look into it more deeply. But then I found that actually I knew Aladdin, I knew Ali Baba, I knew partly the frame story, I knew one or two other elements. But I really had never taken in this extraordinary abundance. I mean, you know, there are romances, there are travel yarns, there are jokes, there are dirty jokes. There are little moral fables, there are animal fables, there are wild, long sort of epics like Sinbad the Sailor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's very, very rich. I mean, you can never really read it all. I still, in a way, haven't, which is rather extraordinary to have written a book.
A richness.
Not have finished it
right,
ever.
Right, a richness right there that Maria Warner says the world needs. Her new book is Stranger Magic, Charmed States, and the Arabian Nights. Marina, please stand by there in London. Listeners, you can join us. Do these tales, this frame, live in your imagination? The young woman and the sultan and the story that must be told every night for her to stay alive. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with Umm Kulthum. We'll be right back.
مطرحنا لهينا وغير شموع الفرق ما تشوف ليالينا ليالينا حبيبي.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a new reading of the great old tales of the Arabian Nights, looking at the power and allure of fantasy and wonderment, enchantment in story. Marina Warner joins us, great British mythographer, joins us today from London. Her terrific big new book is Stranger Magic, Charmed States, and the Arabian Nights. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join this conversation as well. Are you swept away by the tales of 1001 Nights? Do we need the suspension of cold reason and everyday limits these tales provide? Magic carpets, magic lamps. Do we need the trappings of Arabian exoticism to flow with that magic? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Of course, Hollywood has had a heyday with these stories and themes for a long time. Here's a little bit from the trailer of the 1940 film Thief of Baghdad, where a young thief teams up with the deposed King Ahmad. They're both imprisoned by the evil Jafar.
There was a rich and powerful king in Baghdad, and there was a lovable little thief.
The darkness falls. Leave your palace, go among your people, mix with the crowds.
Then fate threw together the powerful king and the little thief on the road to strange adventures.
Strange adventures told and retold in Hollywood and well beyond. Here, 1992, Walt Disney's animated Aladdin. The genie, played by Robin Williams, meets Aladdin for the first time.
10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck. Hang on a second. Whoa! Wow! Does it feel good to be out of there? I'm telling you, nice to be back, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, where are you from? What's your name?
Aladdin.
Aladdin!
Disney has its way with the Arabian Nights. Marina Warner is with us from London. Stranger Magic is her book. And Marina, we've got listeners calling in. Brian in Charlottesville, Virginia. Brian, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Ahem, Tom. I was wondering that this, first I assume that this the original compositions must have been done during the Abbasid caliphate, because Baghdad was sacked in 1258, and I would doubt that it would produce any stories after that.
Mm-hmm.
The real question I have is, Cairo was the center of publishing, and when this information went to Europe, it was manuscript publishing, and it was made possible by the drop in paper prices in Europe. But we had Europe many centuries of contact with the Islamic and the Arab world.
Sure.
Why was this series of stories regarded with such exoticism? rather than just another collection of tales from the East. What made this particular collection so electrically galvanizing to Europeans and shaped the ideas of an Orientalism?
It's a great question. It's a great one, Brian. Thank you very much. Marina Warner.
Well, actually, the great wealth of Baghdad in that period is very well reflected in the stories. And I think that's one of the reasons that they appealed when they appeared in print for the first time in the 18th century. Because whereas our fairy tales often take, you know, Western fairy tales often take place in enchanted forests, and they evoke a kind of society before highly urbanized consumer durables, you know, goods and manufactures. That the Arabian Nights take place in streets, in markets, in bustling, you know, thronged cities. And that was what was beginning to really shape experience in Europe. And I think that the way that the goods in the stories, like the lamp, the famous lamp and the carpet, are particularly the vehicles of enchantment, that really rang a bell. That was a bit different from the sword Excalibur or Pegasus, the winged horse. It was more recognizable that the magic horse in the Arabian Nights is actually an automaton. It's a machine and it has a switch, and you turn the switch and it goes. And so that in a way, that there were sort of reflections of modernity. But, you know, your point about the manuscript circulation, one of the curious aspects of the Nights is that they weren't very appreciated in their own cultures because the Arabic is demotic, it's not classical. And so they didn't circulate at the level of, you know, the intelligentsia, if you like.
Was it an oral tradition there, or was it printed in Arabic?
It wasn't printed in Arabic until later. As your questioner pointed out, as Brian pointed out quite rightly, it circulated in manuscript. There are 22 manuscripts only. That's quite a small number.
Meaning it's circulated in handwritten Arabic manuscripts? Is that what you're...
Yes, and actually one of the ones I've seen, which is a bundle of notebooks that's in one of the London libraries, the you can see the annotations of the person who owned it, and it looks as if it was used for as an oral prompt book. It looks as if, you know, he had kind of marked it up. And there are even little strokes which are crossed through as if he's counting the number of people listening.
Wow. But does that mean, you know, it was widely known in the Arab world, let's say?
Everybody seems to have known them. They seem to have circulated very, very widely, but at the lower levels, if you like, where people then would discard it when they became sophisticated or educated. So there's a kind of vigorous popular vernacular culture going on. And then it needs to be kind of, as it were, discarded. It needs to be repudiated. And so I think when the contacts, as you quite rightly say, took place between the great Ottoman Empire, great Mamluk Empire and so forth, this was not actually something that came through very strongly before the printing of the book. I mean, when you look at visits to the, you know, court in the Sublime Porte, as it's called, it wasn't mentioned. And actually, I was very struck that the earliest artists who bring back, you know, observational drawings and things and prints of Turkey and further points don't ever show jinn and fairies. This is fairly realistic representations.
Amazing.
They don't get into this enchanted dimension, which was considered rather... Well, you know, the word is vulgar, meaning that it belongs to the people, and it's also kind of not very, you know, respectable to kind of believe in these things. But that was the question I wanted to go for. Why did it then become not only respectable, but actually, you know, kind of really enthusiastically adopted?
So it took the print circulation to really bring this to the wide awareness of Europeans. What about in the Arab world and beyond, in its own realm? I think I've seen this described as not so greatly respected there either. It's seen as a kind of pulp fiction.
Yes. Well, that's changing. And that's really interesting. There's now quite a number of marvelous writers in Arabic who have actually modeled themselves on aspects of the Nights. I mean, Naguib Mahfouz, who won the Nobel Prize, used elements of the storytelling structure and so forth in his novels. But it began apparently at the end of the 19th century that the sort of appreciation that so many European cultures were showing to this book and to its ingenuity and its abundance led Arabic writers to think about it in a different way.
We'll look more at its electric effect when it finally did land in the 18th century there in Europe. Marina Warner joins us from London. Her new book is Stranger Magic. Keith is calling from the highway outside Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Keith. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, thanks for having me. I had just an interesting observation. I'm a career soldier. Mm-hmm. I spent a significant amount of time in Baghdad. And while I was there, a modern translation fell into my hands, and I read it quite avidly. And things that struck me as I would speak to the locals that I knew and some of the interpreters I had quite a closer relationship with, they speak of this as kind of a living story, the kind of thing that they learned on their grandmother's knee, you know, when they were being babysat or bedtime stories. Wow. And I thought that was quite striking. And another thing, one of the tribes in the stories in the translation was a Janabi tribe, which was phonetically identical to a modern tribe, the Janabis, that, well, actually, they tended to be terrorists, but you know, just on an interesting note that it's very much still alive there in the streets of Baghdad.
Keith,
it's very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so happy for that witness. I mean, Marina Warner, there's a very contemporary American soldier reading Arabian Nights in Baghdad and talking about it with regular Iraqis there, the Baghdadis of today. What about that
Absolutely.
Currency?
Absolutely. Well, in fact, one of my impulses originally when I began writing the book was to try and understand something more of the culture, because, you know, I minded very much that we were having these very bitter conflicts and, you know, very violent, distressing, continuing problems. And I thought, what can I contribute as a writer who writes mostly about fairy tales? I mean, what can I do to help and illuminate and try and, you know, look at this in a slightly different light? This was the era of the moment of the clash of civilizations, so-called.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got very concerned with showing. I mean, it struck me this conversation had been going on at this level, in this way, for a very long time. That the imaginations of East and West had been entangled and mutually influencing and inspiring each other. And that this was an interesting way to kind of look at it, to go at it.
But does
and,
it...
And the story... Sorry.
Well, I just wonder, but does it illuminate or does it exoticize? Does it obscure to look at tales of fantasy to learn about this culture, these cultures?
Well, it doesn't. It's not so much that it illuminates directly. It's not like going up with a camera and taking a photograph, because after all, you know, they were written a long time ago too, and so you can't take it as a kind of, you know, loop. It's not a guidebook. Mm-hmm. But I think that it shows that, for example, let's take the magic carpet, which doesn't play such a huge part in the stories, but it becomes really, really singled out by the readers in France and England and then, of course, in America, the filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Why? And that's because they recognized in it that this flight of imagination that takes place in the stories around flight, there's so many wonderful scenes of flying in the nights, and this was, you know, recognized as a possibility. And here was a way of thinking that could open up this territory, you know, that would take us to another world. And it's very interesting that many of the kind of inventions of flying are anticipate and in these kinds of fairy tales anticipate what then happens much, much, much later.
And
I mean, flying is invented in literature long before it's invented by scientists.
And that's one portal into your observation, that these tales of fantasy actually may play a really important kind of complementary role with the Age of Reason being rolled out in Europe, Dream, and much more may follow.
Yes, that's exactly right. And also the Dream, the word you used, one of the things that starts happening in the 18th century and, of course, gets much stronger in the 19th and then finally with Freud becomes really part of our, you know, natural landscape, and that is the idea that dreams are a key in some way to personality. And the Arabian Nights is full of psychology that depends on interpreting dreams. Not, of course, exactly the way that Freudian psychoanalysis does it, but not a million miles away. And that's why I was amused and thought it was an unconscious move on Freud's part that he covered his sofa famously in his consulting room with a beautiful Turkish carpet, which is like a magic carpet, on which the patient lies in order to experience these truthful dreams.
How woven together we all are, from the tales of the Arabian Nights to Sigmund Freud's couch. Marina Warner is with us. Her new book is Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go right to the region, if we may, Marina. Joining us right now from Qatar is Amira El-Zain. She's a Lebanese, professor of Arabic studies at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service in Qatar. She's working on a book herself about the Arabian Nights. She's author of Islam, Arabs, and the Intelligent World of the Jinn and Other Poems. Amira El-Zain, thank you so much for joining us today with Marina Warrior. Warner, thank you very much for being here.
Well, I'm delighted,
Amira.
Thank you,
Tom. Thank you for having me.
What do you think when you see here we are now in the 21st century and you've still got, you know, here's Western scholar dipping into the tales of 1001 Nights to illuminate human nature and maybe something about this region, your region. Is this a productive, I don't know, insightful way for us to look at your neck of the woods, your part of the world, Amira?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have read the book of Marina, and I admire her immense knowledge and the way she illuminated the stories of the night. And I think it's she's a witness of the importance of our need, our human need, to tell stories and listen to stories at the same time. And I think that what she gives us in her book is how the West has been inspired from these days. And I think Stranger Magic is really an extraordinary tool to understand the other, in the sense that the writings of great poets and artists and whatnot in the West is also inspired from these things. And the Arab world, you know, reciprocates, and we read them again, and we are inspired by them. It's a kind of eternal return, if you will, in the sense that one region of the world gives a tale, another part of the world is inspired from them. And then we read what the West has written and produced, and we write again about them. And it's really an extraordinary eternal return. And I think that also there is, it's not only that the tales save the stories, as Marina said, mm-hmm. It's also our need to discover what is behind the visible world. And that's why the curiosity of the Western world, they were so amazed by this corpus.
What is behind the visible world? And here's a window into it through 1001 Nights. Amira El-Zain, I'm afraid our line is a little rough, but we really appreciate your being with us from Qatar today. We're very grateful to you for being there with us from your spot in Qatar. Thank you so much for joining us, Amira.
It's wonderful to hear you.
and Marina sends her best across those many miles.
Yes, because you know, Amira's book, The Intelligent Life of the Jinn, was very important to me.
Jinn as in genie.
Jinn as in genie is the plural. Yes, mm-hmm. Genies, jinn. Because her book is about the meaning of these spirit beings who are in the Quran. For someone like myself, they are like fairies to some extent, but they have a wonderful narrative power because they're capable of both good and evil. So they're unpredictable. They can go both ways. They can deliver you from harm, and they can also place you in great danger.
Our soldier calling in earlier talked about discussing these stories from Arabian Nights in Baghdad just in recent years. We all know fairy tales, grim fairy tales, and others in the West. Whether we're in the UK or the US, are these stories more prominent in the Arab world than the Grimm fairy tales are here, or more or less equivalent? How do you look at them, Marina, in terms of their cultural currency?
Well, actually, they're slightly shrouded in difficulty within some areas of the Arabic-speaking world, because the picture of magic that they give mm-hmm. is not actually entirely tolerated by the current authorities of Islam, actually, in some countries. Not all of them.
A little racy, impure.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, for example, Gamal al-Ghitani, who's a very leading novelist.
Mm-hmm.
I heard music.
Yeah,
the very leading novelist in Cairo. Printed, he's the editor of a literary magazine, he produced a new edition of the Arabian Nights, and he was called up to before a Sharia court.
Marina Warner, stand by there in London. We're talking about a new reading of the great old tales of the Arabian Nights. Stranger Magic is the book. Behind us right here, Jin Jin from Mickey Hart, drummer for the Grateful Dead, out with a new album, Mysterium Tremendum. This sound, this culture, still very much in our ears. We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new reading of the great old tales of the Arabian Nights, looking at the power and allure of fantasy and enchantment in story. The great mythographer Marina Warner joins us from London. Her big new book is Stranger Magic, Charmed States, and the Arabian Nights. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. Do these tales still live in your imagination? The young woman, the sultan, the story that must be told every night for her to stay alive. Do we need these stories? Do we need the trappings of Arabian exoticism somehow to flow with the magic? Can you see these tales as the pulp fiction of their day in the Arab world? Are they losing their grip on us as our own fantasy literature and much more explodes? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Marina, lots of interesting response online here. Here Terry writes, a poor, powerless young woman valued only for her physical beauty and virginity outmaneuvers a rich, powerful, cruel man, and she asks, what's not to love about these stories? but a listener in Vermont writes, I would think the sheer male superiority mindset of the time would make it totally unacceptable to have a concubine or a young girl foiling the sultan night after night. Yeah, what about that? Was it tweaking the nose of the gender power structure of the day? Why was that okay?
Well, it's a fascinating aspect. The women in the stories are not only Shahrazad beguiling the sultan with her clever tongue, but there are many courageous women who depart on adventures dressed as men, who show, you know, when they're often rather kind of, you know, volatile husbands behave badly, they show unbelievable determination to transform them. So there is a very strong power energy from below to kind of try and change the status quo. And actually, you know, I was very attracted to the stories because it goes so much against our normal conventional view of Islam. And, you know, the women are marvelously articulate and very independent in the nights. And that's really kind of encouraging. And it also shows that we shouldn't think about it in too monolithic a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, history is constantly changing. It's very mercurial, and we can move it in a different direction. And we've seen that in the Arab Spring, and you know, mm-hmm. that needs supporting from a context of the possibilities its own history shows, not what we impose from mm-hmm. our ideas of democracy and emancipation, but their own history, as reflected in the stories, shows the possibilities.
You were saying earlier that in a way, in the Age of Reason, 18th century Europeans may have found a way to attribute sort of realms of enchantment and magic to the other, to the foreigner, in this case the Islamic world, the Arab world, that they didn't quite feel comfortable embracing themselves. Of course, then much later, many of us will have heard of Edward Said's critique of Orientalism, and that is exoticizing a whole realm of, you know, quite real flesh and blood compatriots on the planet. What about that? Is that a danger here at the same time as we look at these, that, you know, suddenly we're drawing genies in the streets of Baghdad instead of perhaps of looking what's really there?
Yes, no, I have tried to. I mean, I admire Edward Said's work, and I knew him, and I count him as a friend, and I would not want to appear to be kind of, criticizing him, except modifying his important arguments about prejudiced responses to the East, to the Orient. I want to just take them for you. It's 1978, mm-hmm. his famous book, that polemic. Mm-hmm. It's quite a long time ago, and as we know, many, many things have happened. And he himself, in his last books, took a very different... I mean, he did modify his own arguments. He was very interested in the efforts at mutual understanding. What he was decrying was the efforts to command and possess. He was decrying mastery and you know, invasion and oppression.
Neo-colonialism,
than,
maybe.
Yes, rather than, but the impulse to understand, and you know, the orchestra, the West-East Divan Orchestra, which is this marvelous experiment, not experiment any longer, this marvelous phenomenon, which has now influenced other similar phenomena of Israeli young musicians and musicians from the Arabic world playing together and learning each other. You know, if you watch the DVD about the orchestra, these young people say they've never seen one of the others. They've never seen someone from Israel. They've never seen someone. They've never seen an Arab before. And they meet and they play the violin side by side together in that part of the orchestra. And this is an extraordinary... Well, that orchestra, Edward Said founded with Daniel Barenboim, and it's called after a suite of poems by Goethe, the great German romantic poet, which is completely orientalizing. He pretends to be an oriental poet. He writes in an oriental stanza. He adopts all kinds of locutions and imagery from the tradition. Goethe himself tried to learn a bit of Arabic and a bit of Persian. So I thought this is very paradoxical, you know. Edward Said is decrying Orientalism, but here he's called his orchestra after this, you know, absolutely evident example. So his own opinions, you know, became much more... Well, they just became more embracing and more subtle about how the history could be told after what was a young man's book, which was a cry of rage and protest, very necessary and very valuable, that happened at the time, woke us all up.
Maria Warner's new book is Stranger Magic. She looks there at the tales of 1001 Nights, and there is certainly exoticism. It goes to magic. She writes in the book, magical thinking structures the process of imagination, and imagining something can and sometimes must precede the fact or the act that has shaped many features of Western civilization, but its influence has been constantly disavowed since the Enlightenment, and its action and effects, consequently, misunderstood. Michelle's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Michelle, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To your illustrious guest, I'm just having fun.
Good.
I'm 69 years old, and when I was a little girl with my brothers and sisters, my five brothers and sisters, my father would read from the 101, listen to me.
Thousand, no less. Yes, yes. Lucky you.
And it was very popular then. But I don't even think that parents today know about it, and it certainly is not on any reading list in any of the schools, because I've got a grandson in college, and they wouldn't know anything about it, you know, except for what I've read to them.
Yeah, that's
and,
very...
My brothers and sisters hated it because... I said, no, read from the Arabian Nights, read from the Arabian Nights. And my father was one of these animated readers, and I am too, and my grandchildren and my children.
We can hear that.
But my favorite was Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves.
Yeah.
Yeah, with a very cunning and clever and loyal and true slave girl.
Yes.
In that one, Marjana.
Yes. Oh, Michelle, sounds like you carried the torch for the 1001 Nights. Marina Warner, I mean, I think I'm reading here, though, that Ali Baba, what, Sinbad, Aladdin, were these really part of the Arabian Nights, or were they somehow additions, late additions?
Well, it is true that Aladdin and Ali Baba, we haven't got an early Arabic manuscript for them. We haven't got one that predates the French translation. And it's thought that the first translator, Antoine Galland, possibly interpolated these into his great work.
What does that mean, interpolate? Where do they come from, then?
It means that they have got elements that, you know, reflect other stories. But that really is a continuation of the tradition. I mean, what Michelle there is... Was it Michelle she was called?
Yes.
Your caller?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What Michelle there was saying is exactly what the tradition is. You take the story and you start in an animated way, retelling it and re-embroidering it. So while people used to think that it was very impertinent of Galland to put, you know, his own work into the book, actually he was just doing what has always been done until you start getting definitive editions.
And that's what made the book over the centuries.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Right.
Yes, it's the work of many voices and many hands. And, of course, we don't know who, you know, there's no author on it. We don't know who actually collated it, put it together, wrote some of the parts. You know, there is no person, it were, called Homer who made this book.
A kind of chorus.
But it's the method of its making probably does reflect something like the Odyssey or the Iliad, which probably were also, you know, combinations, fusions of traditions coming together in one definitive, marvelous version.
Michelle, thank you very much for your call. Marina Warner writes, in Stranger Magic, I want to ask if it is possible to set the Arabian Nights in relation to the concerns of modern society, modern consciousness, as they were developing in the Age of Reason. How do such flights of fancy speak to reason? John in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on the air, John.
Thank you. I'm just I'm throwing something out there to consider. Marina had mentioned the automaton and fancies of flight and how it correlates to our current realities. And I'm wondering, you know, this contextual and perhaps effective storytelling over the ages, could there be a connection? And this is just a comment. You know, it's pretty far out.
Okay.
Could there be a connection between mankind's experience on the globe with perhaps alien encounters where there have been pictograms on rocks all over every continent and artwork displaying, you know, revelations of human beings experiencing flight and dancing, and these carpets show up and these automatrons show up and they're flight machines, and how could this perhaps maybe be an extension of that experience back then? You know, no one ever knows, because obviously there's a big controversial effect here. There's many people, many scholars believe that aliens existed, many discount it. But is this partly a storytelling passing on of this experiential?
John, let us pick it up right there. I think we've got it.
Yes.
Aspirational, Marina, or experiential?
Well, my way of interpreting isn't really so much historical. So I wouldn't ever say that you could use it as evidence that there were flying people who came from another planet. But because I read such material, such imaginative works of art, as metaphorical, so that I read them to show how certain structures are in place. Now, to give you an example, to move from flight, one of the aspects that interested me in the Knights was the fantastic fortunes that appear and disappear. The money is, you know,
literal fortunes, riches.
Yes, you know, they just come out of of thin air. And in a way, so to look at your question, you know, your question, I wouldn't say this is an evidence that money did come out of thin air and disappear, you know, as it were, produced by jinn. But there's an imaginative understanding that that is the way money behaves. And, you know, but boy, have we learned that in the last decades.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
you know,
if
this is extremely prophetic in the Knights.
Yes.
And there are wonderful stories in which the hero, you know, operates the most incredible pyramid scheme or the, you know, in the Knights, it's, you know, with the help of jinn.
Yes.
But, you know, but actually you can understand them in the light of, you know, capital flow.
No kidding. Spectral riches. We've all become familiar with just how fast the pile of gold can vanish. Marina Warner is with us from London. Her new book is Stranger Magic. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Joe in Charleston, South Carolina. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Anyway, I've been reading the new Bantam edition of the 1001. And my understanding is that the Grimm's fairy tales had just come out and that had primed, and then the translation for the French came out, and it was basically a, if you thought Grimm's were great, you should see what I've got here for 1001.
That's interesting.
Well, actually,
Joe, let us pick it up right there. What about the sequence of this and the potential
priming? In fact, the French translation and then the first English translation are at the beginning of the 18th century, and the Grimm's brothers' collection, Children and Household Tales, is 1812, with the last edition, their own compilation, their last one, 1857. So it's quite a big difference. But your caller is talking about the Victorian translations, which did become very popular as well. So because the Bantam edition is based on Richard Burton, I think. It's Jack Zipes' version. I think the Bantam is Jack Zipes, the great fairy tale scholar. It's his collection and edition. And sort of rewriting gently of the Richard Burton of 1001 Nights, and that's 1880s. That's full Victorian, edition. Very full too, very complete, very many riches of stories.
Marina, you write in Stranger Magic, you say, "I want to look without squeamishness at the contemporary uses of enchantment, at the continuing vitality of magic in literature, as well as its structural presence in the everyday culture." And you mean now? I mean, you're really saying there's a, in this case, a contemporary role for this, and not only by any means from Arabian Nights. We've got a listener on Facebook, Ron, who writes, "I don't think we need this type of storytelling now. We have other alternatives that take us beyond movies, TV shows, you name it." I mean, you yourself point out with Harry Potter and all the rest, there's still clearly an appetite for this and many outlets for it now. Do we still, maybe we don't need to look to the Arabian other anymore for the kind of enchantment you're describing, or is there something special there?
Well, I think that these stories have flowed very deeply now into our own much richer storytelling culture than in the past. I mean, you know, it has been an explosion recently of some wonderful writers for, you know, the children and the crossover market, like Philip Pullman, who, you know, draws on this sort of material and knows it very well. And I think that, but I don't see it as an either-or at all. And I also, in a sense, don't really see it as, what I was trying to do is, not exactly neutralize it, but not see it as Arabian and exotic, but actually show how closely it matches some of our experience. I mean, another example, apart from the money, the fantastic money, but that speaks to our time very strongly, is the importance of words in the Arabian Nights. Mm. Not only the word of Shahrazad as she changes the sultan subtly into a better man. Mm-hmm. But also within the stories, there are magic words. I mean, the famous one is abracadabra, or, you know, that's in not in these stories, but or open sesame. Mm. But actually, that idea of word magic, we observe that quite strongly in contemporary society, and we don't really acknowledge or examine it.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, there's been quite rightly a rise in intolerance of hate speech. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I'm completely on, though I'm a freedom of speech person, mm-hmm. I'm also completely on the side of, you know, the total discouragement of hate speech.
Because of its power,
but
it's
actually,
dark
if somebody,
power.
Exactly, because mm-hmm. of its power. You know, anyone who's ever been sworn at or picked up the phone and there's a dirty phone caller at the end, mm-hmm. at the other end, knows that this is an extremely disturbing experience. It's, and yet nothing has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
sure.
So that is an example of the, you know, this sort of mm-hmm. mysterious area, which isn't, you don't have to be a belief, but you don't have to believe in invisible forces. You don't have to believe that they're supernatural to acknowledge that there are ways that we are changed by things that are beyond our reason. It's not reasonable to be totally shaken by someone swearing at you.
It does
happen.
It does. It takes 1001 nights, but Shahrazad succeeds. Her job is sort of there clearing the anger from men through story, and it's a powerful realm that Marina Warner takes us into very compellingly. The new book is Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. Marina Warner in London, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.